Good evening, and a very warm welcome to everyone. Thank you for venturing out on this delightful evening with the snow holding up. It will not come until after the class. Our topic is the weekday Tehillim group, and I'd like to start with a quick story putting Tehillim in perspective. Story is told about a mom sends her kids off to camp, and very responsibly she writes a letter to them every week and encloses $5 in the envelope, and here's a little something for canteen. And she's really surprised that she never ever gets a letter back. Never. This is going on the first trip of camp, 4 weeks straight. She writes every week. Never any reciprocity. She's talking about this to one of her friends, and her friend senses her frustration and says the solution is simple. You write the letter. At the end of the letter, you write, I hope you enjoy the $5 for canteen that I've enclosed. And don't enclose the $5. See what happens. Sure enough, letter comes back the next week. Mom, thanks for the delightful letter. Here's what's going on in baseball, in punch bowl, in volleyball, in tennis. We even went horseback riding. By the way, the $5 that you said you were enclosing for canteen, you might have possibly forgotten. And she got the letter she wanted. There are many times that HaKadosh Baruch Hu withholds something from us, not because he means to withhold it. He intends to give it. There's a big package of gifts that he intends to give. But if he gave them, he'd never hear from us. So he withholds them, only anticipating that we will ask and he will give. At the moment of the Yamsa, for example, Moshe starts davening this heartfelt prayer, the Egyptians to his back, the sea to his front. What's he going to do? And he's going to pray up a storm. And Hashem says, Lo eis ata laha'arich batfila. Now is not the time for lengthy prayers. Sheyiso shiruyim b'tzar. Because the Jews as a nation are in pain. You can be sure I intend to save them. Lo isata laharich batfila. Don't daven long. But you gotta daven. You gotta daven short. But it's not like you have to change my opinion, Hashem says. When Moshe wanted to go to the land of Israel, he davened over 500 prayers to be allowed into the land of Israel because Hashem didn't want him to go. So if you want to change Hashem's mind, that's one type of prayer. But here, we're not asking to change Hashem's mind. Hashem just wants that he should hear from you now and then. And that's the role of a certain type of prayer, which is described, Har'ini esmar'ayich, show me your vision, show me where you look when you're in trouble. Hashmi'ini eskolech, let me hear your voice. You're in trouble, who do you pray to? Oh, you pray to me, I'm glad to hear it. And Hashem got the letter back that he was waiting for, waiting to have a relationship with us. They once brought to Chafetz Chaim the Tehillim of his mother. The great Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim became a legend in his own time. Chafetz Chaim once had to be a character witness for someone in the community. So before he said his testimony, the lawyer says to the judge, I just want your honor to understand who I'm introducing. They say on the Chafetz Chaim that one time he invited a guest into his home and the guest stole the silver candlesticks. And they didn't realize until the guy was way out the door. And he was halfway down the block running with the silver candlesticks. And the Chafetz Chaim started running after him, screaming, "I forgive you! I forgive you! If you need them, you can take them! I forgive you!" So the judge said to the lawyer, he said, "That's a nice story. You know, it's a folk story. It's a nice story. Do you believe such a story happened with a human being, that a human being could be like that?" So the lawyer leans up to the judge and he said, "Your Honor, I don't believe the story either. But I want you to know, they don't say stories like that about you and me. He's a legend. Even in his own lifetime, he was a legend. They once brought him the Tehillim of his mother, the psalm book of his mother. And the Chafetz Chaim stood up in reverence. He said, all that I have become in my lifetime is because of my mother's prayers. And this was her Tehillim. He stood up in reverence. Tehillim is very powerful. We're told that Hashem gave Moshe five books. Five books of Torah. And David in turn wrote five books of Tehillim. Hashem, this is what you want from us. Well, this is our response. It's not a response of anger. It's not a response, you know, things, I'm doing the mitzvahs and it's not going exactly the way I wanted. But it's a response. It's a human response. It's an expression. If I'm happy, I want to tell you. If I'm frustrated, I want to tell you. There's open dialogue. Constant communication. All of prayer is seasonal. The year goes through cycles. It's an upbeat type of part of the year. It's a frustrating time of the year. Tisha B'Av time, Purim time. Different feelings. Likewise, in our lifetime, there are different cycles that we go through. There are moments of absolute and total euphoria, joy, and other times, it's difficult. Purim, which the season of Purim has already begun, especially since tomorrow at 5:27, we begin the fast of Esther, it's the season of Purim. We're told that Yom Kippur, the famous Day of Atonement, where we are lofty like angels, it is merely Yom Kippurim, a day that's almost like Purim. Almost as good as Purim. Because on Purim, we can accomplish through joy what on Yom Kippur we accomplish through fasting. And if you accomplish it through joy, it's greater. It's greater to do a mitzvah out of joy. Why is Purim so powerful? So we have a beautiful concept called Refuah Kodem Lamaka, the healing before the hit. You know, in history sometimes God hits us, but in this case, He prepared the healing before the hit. You ever go for an inoculation? You take the kids to get their shots, immunizations. So the nurse is very particular how she does it. She does, on the one hand, have the thing she's going to give the pierce with, On the other hand, the Band-Aid is all lined up already. And the lollipop that she's going to give afterwards is also there on the table already. And she knows exactly how she's going to do this. I took my kids just 2 weeks ago. One nurse is giving the shot, and the second nurse is putting on the Band-Aid. Chick-chock. And that's the story of Purim. Hashem intended to scare us with Haman, with a decree that was threatening to destroy the Jewish people. He wanted to hear from us, wanted to hear our prayers, so he withheld something. He brought us into a period of uncertainty. But what he did before that was he prepared all the Band-Aids as necessary. Esther is already chosen as the queen. I mean, what Hashem had to orchestrate in order to make that happen. Vashti, the queen of the empire, the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, had to be killed. So, we know the Purim story. She gets killed in the wildest story. He invites her to his party. She doesn't want to come. He kills her. But Hashem needs Esther in there. And Vashti's got to go. And Esther is in. And Mordechai also has to be recorded as a friend of the king. So that at the critical moment, Harvona can walk in and say, Haman, who the king is buddy-buddy with, is causing all this trouble, trying to annihilate a nation that's the same nation as the queen. And Mordechai is the real friend of the king. He's the one who saved his life. And it's recorded. What do we see in the story of Purim? Hashem already intended to fix the problem. And every person has a problem in their lives. Whatever your problem is, whether it's your problem, or your friend's problem, your brother's, your sister's problem, but there's a problem on our minds. Hashem set the stage of Purim describing situations where Hashem intends to give the gift. He intends to bring the healing. It's all lined up to happen. But you have to ask. You ask, I'll give it to you. And that's the story of Purim. We see clearly Hashem's ready to give it. He's got Esther, he's got Mordechai. Everyone's lined up. And now enter Haman's center stage. The lights are on him. Watch his moves. If you pray, I'll kill him. I'll get him off the stage. Him and his gallows and his 10 sons. But you gotta pray. You gotta ask. Purim ends up, though, becoming even more than what I just described to give you what Hashem intends to give, but you have to ask. We have a tradition that on Purim we give tzedakah generously. Kol haposhet yad, anybody who sticks out his hand, we try to give him something. During the year, you could ask him for his letter of recommendation. Which rabbi endorses you? Which organization has checked you out? On Purim, we don't do that. On Purim, you give him something. Jew stretches out his hand, I need something. And Kaviyachal Hashem does the same thing for us. Even if it's something that Hashem never wanted to give you, He'll give you something because you asked on Purim. Amazing concept. They say a very cute story of a big factory that the biggest machine in the factory wasn't working. There are 300 workers milling around, nothing to do because this machine is not working. They can't feed anything in, they can't take anything out, it's not working. So they hear about a certain mechanic, engineer, he knows this machine. So the CEO of the company says, get him over here as soon as you can. So they call this guy, they find him, cell phone, they find where he is. And he says, I'm a state over, I'm a state away from you, but if it's important enough, I have my own private plane with me, I'll fly in, I'll be there, I'll take care of it. The CEO says, no problem, I mean, we're closed. Bring the guy in. He says, clear the parking lot, I'm coming in for a landing. He lands in the parking lot, he comes out, takes a look at the machine, pulls out his hammer, he gives one loud bang at one spot of the machine, and suddenly a piece falls into place, and he flips the switch and the machine is working. He walks over to the CEO, and he says, that'll be $1,000, please. $1,000? To pull out the hammer and give a bang? $1,000? The guy doesn't let up. He says, yeah, $1,000. $1 for the bang and $999 to know where to bang. That's Purim. You could say the same prayer any time during the year. But if you had the wisdom to say it on Purim, then you score big. $999 to know where to give the bang. What I'd like to share with you tonight is chapter 13, Kapitel Yud Gimel, in Tehillim. One of the reasons that I chose it is for this group, I'd like to limit myself, if you will, to chapters that are fairly short, less than 10 verses, so that we can try to do the chapter together, verse by verse, and appreciate it together, and perhaps recite it together as well. So, it is one of the shorter chapters in Tehillim. It's also a very powerful one, in which David, King David, describes enormous frustration, what he was going through, his enemies, the pressure he was under, the desperation that he felt. But it goes full circle, because by the last verse, he walks with utter confidence that Hashem will come through for him. Let's begin. You'll notice this is taken from the Art Scroll, Hebrew, English, and transliterated. So if you have trouble with the Hebrew vowels or whatever, this is a phenomenal tool. You can check yourself how to pronounce everything exactly. Verse 1, Pasuk Aleph. Lamanatzeach mizmor ledavid. They translate, for the conductor, this was one of the chapters that would often be sung, a psalm written by David. Let's go a drop deeper here, though. The word Lamanatzayach, according to Rav Hirsch, comes from the word Nitzuach, which means victory. And in this very first verse, the verse of introduction, David is already setting the tone for what this chapter will accomplish. We are addressing God who grants victory. In other words, Hashem is all-powerful, all-knowing. I mean, there are lots of things we could say about Hashem. But what David is invoking is Hashem's power to bring victory. And bringing victory is because David's very clear. I am praying to Hashem with utter bitachon, trust, that He has the power to pull me through. which is one of the key factors to prayer. Whenever you trust in something, that's what you're trusting. If you trust your almighty bank account, that's what's going to pull you through. If you trust your boss and don't appreciate that if something went wrong here, Hashem can provide for you in a different way. So then whatever you trust, that's what you're trusting. David starts off, ultimate trust in Hashem. Good bitachon skills are phenomenal. They're phenomenal for honesty. Because if you know that Hashem can provide one way or the other, you're not tempted to bend the rules. And for serenity. Because a person who believes that Hashem can orchestrate things, and this is something worth exercising yourself to figure out, are there blockages in our way of thinking? Do we somehow think that perhaps Hashem might not be able to come through on this circumstance? Because we need to know that Hashem could. Otherwise the prayer is somewhat flawed. That confidence is how David walks into this chapter. Mizmor leDavid, the Gemara says, that it makes a difference whether it says Mizmor leDavid Asam to David, or leDavid Mizmor, his name first, and then Mizmor. In the case of Mizmor leDavid, it means that David first had to say the Mizmor, he first had to go through the motions of the prayer before he could be in the mood. He starts off utterly depressed. And as the psalm continues, he gets a hold of himself and is able to put things in perspective. Pasuk Beis, verse 2. Listen to the way he talks. Ad ono Hashem tishkocheni netzach. He laments. Until when, Hashem, will you forget me forever? Eternally. Until when will I be forgotten eternally? Now, by definition, David is, you know, being a drop confusing here, because he has mixed emotions. What does it mean, until when will I be forgotten eternally? Forgotten eternally means I'll never be remembered. He's asking, until when? So he understands that there may be a change, and he's not being forgotten eternally. What's he talking about? He's saying that in my current situation, there is no hope. Basic inertia will not get me through this. Just persevere. I'm in a bind that only Hashem can extricate me from. In my current situation, it is eternal. Now, if you send out the Mounties, maybe you'll get me out of this. But in its current situation, I can't get out. And likewise, the end of the same pasuk, Adonatas tires panecha mimeni. How long will you hide your countenance from me? We'll see as the psalm develops that one of David's frustrations is not that you must answer me now, but at least give me some hope. Let me feel that you're listening to me. That tomorrow will be better, even if it's not today. You'll notice most of people's problems. If you listen to other people's problems or you listen to your own problems, the problem is not that the current thing is insurmountable. The problem is that you don't feel that tomorrow's going to be better. You don't feel that there's hope. That's that old wise piece of advice. If you're totally overwhelmed, get a good night's sleep. That just kind of forces you, tomorrow will be better. Because when a person has that sense that tomorrow will be better, that's half of the encouragement. Solving it would be the rest. But half of it is just give me the sense that there's hope. Pasuk Gimel, David continues to express his frustration. Adono oshis etzos benafshi. How long will I continue setting schemes for myself? When a person's totally desperate, what do? They try desperate solutions. And David realizes, imagine, God forbid, someone has a family member terminally ill. And the doctor says, you know, there's one other hope. There's an experimental drug that I really don't have too much faith in, but they're trying, and you'd be legal to sign the 43-page document of consent, and we would administer it. If you want. That's what David's talking about. I'm so desperate that I'm willing to try schemes. He describes graphically the problem. Yogon bilvavi yomam. In my heart there's melancholy even by day. Let's remember. What does day symbolize? Jewish literature? Light, hope. Daybreak, dawn, future, solutions. What does David say? Even at the moments of light, when things theoretically should be optimistic for me, what am I feeling? Melancholy. Again, let's go back to our analogy of a very sick patient. Even when things are going good, they could suffer from fearing the relapse syndrome. So even though everything's fine, it's yomam, it's day, but they're living with fear. When's it coming back? What's the next test going to tell me? Person who finally resolves things with his boss, but they're not really resolved. So even by daytime, even in good times, everything's going smoothly. But he's like burying himself with worry. When's the next axe going to fall? And David says, I'm not living. Finally, Ad ana yarim ayavi alai. How long will my enemy triumph over me? So the simple explanation here about enemy is that we're dealing with an external enemy. And that's the easy way. When you're reading such a chapter, typically most people read it, it's referring to an external enemy. You know, you're dealing with Iraq, when we were dealing with the former Soviet Union. You're dealing with Afghanistan, with the Taliban. You know, you're dealing with an external enemy. But the truth is, if you take this to a deeper level, one can have an enemy that's on a much more personal level. Very personal. Person has a bad habit that's basically threatening their existence, that just keeps coming back, and they can't overcome it, and they suffer. I want to share with you a fascinating story from Rabbi A.J. Twersky in one of his books. He titles it A Eulogy. He writes, this is a eulogy written by a person recovering from cocaine. I find his book here, by the way, fascinating. It's good for any bad habit. It's the same recovery process. Person who finds themselves getting angry, it's the same recovery process. He writes the eulogy on the bad habit. Quote, I suppose that in parting I should say, how much I love you. That's what eulogies are about, right? But all I can say is I hate you. You deceived me. You promised to make the world pleasant for me, and I believed you. You did not tell me that your help will be brief, and that afterwards I would feel even worse. You played games with me. You teased me. And you never made me as comfortable as you did the first time. You took everything away from me. The love of my family, my home, my job, my friends, my dignity. And I would still have pursued you, but I had no energy to do so. I was crushed, broken in body, mind, and spirit. Yet even at this moment when I bury you, you threaten to come out of the grave and haunt me. You are a liar. You never wanted to make me happy. And even though he's writing about a drug addiction, but the same thing is true by any addiction. What's an addiction? Something that intellectually we know we should not be doing, but we can't seem to control ourselves. Person has a bad midah, bad character trait. We mentioned anger. Pessimism is the same thing. Why bother trying? It won't work out anyway. Stinginess. You know intellectually that you have only what to gain to endear yourself to your friends. But you can't bring yourself to do it. So you're drowning in stinginess. It could be a behavior. Person has credit card debt. And he just keeps window shopping, which somehow seems to end up into regular shopping. And they can't control themselves. The enemy is not necessarily in this chapter an external evil enemy. It could be on a very personal level as well. Anything that a person is sinking into to the point that they begin to feel helpless. Tehillim, generally, is a mix of intellectually conveying thoughts, but also a blend of poetry. There's symmetry. Now, it may not necessarily rhyme. It may not have the beat that we anticipate in poetry, but logically, there's poetry. I'd like to show you how Pasuk Beis and Gimel, verses 2 and 3, are awesomely symmetrical with the next two verses. You'll notice that in verses 2 and 3, the words ad ona, until when, occur four times. You got me? In verse 2, you got two stanzas, ad ona. And then again in verse 3, you've got two stanzas that begin with the words ad ona. The very first ad ona is the intro. And we're not going to find a parallel in the coming verses. That's simply the intro. The intro is, this has gotten so bad that I feel abandoned eternally. In my current situation, there is no out unless Hashem makes a miracle or a mini miracle for me to get me out. The next ones, though, are all symmetrical. The first one was, until when, Tastir espanecha mimeni, will you hide your countenance from me? At least give me a glimpse of light. Take a look at Pasuk Daled. Verse 4. Habita aneni Hashem Elokai. Look at me. Answer me, Hashem. And then, Ha'ira einai. Enlighten my eyes, pen ishan hamoves, lest death be brought upon me that I should sleep the sleep of death. The term abita aneni, look, answer me, pay attention to me, correlates to the expression that Hashem has hidden his countenance from me. Just look at me, pay attention to me, even if you're not ready to answer me. The next statement, ha'ira enai, enlighten my eyes, corresponds to the desperation of setting schemes within myself, because I saw no hope. Now, if you enlighten my eyes, then I think, oh, I don't have to go with this desperate thing. I have a different idea that at least might make sense, a different approach. Just to get the full picture, let's do Pasuk Hey together with it. Pen Yomar Ayivi Yechalte, verse 5. Lest my enemy boast, I have overcome him. Tzara Yagilu Ki Emot. The tormentors are already rejoicing the minute that I falter. As they see me starting to go down, even before they get me, I already sense. And sometimes the only thing that gets a person galvanized is the knowledge that the enemy would rejoice. And therefore pick yourself up. Now on the statement, Pen Ishan Hamoves, at the end of verse 4, lest I sleep the sleep of death, we should be aware that this is one of the most powerful ways to pray to Hashem. If you have something that you need, that is really what we use the expression, do or die. I need this. We have Rachel in the story of Chumash saying to Yaakov, if I don't have a child, if I don't have a future, then I'm like dead. That's a very powerful statement. When a person says, I have lost my functionality, my life is not functional. A very powerful statement. The Me'am Lois, one of the commentaries, says a very interesting story. Very insightful. He says, there was once a nobleman, and he had a daughter. And this nobleman got very sick, he realized he was dying. So he transferred all his assets to a caretaker, a friend that he trusted, and his orders were, do not give my daughter a penny of it until she gets married. What did he want? He wants that she should be self-sufficient. She doesn't want her living off the fat of the land. She'll be spoiled. She's a talented girl. Let her earn her keep. When she gets married, you can give it to her. She'll be mature enough to deal with the assets. A cousin of the nobleman dies. A cousin of the nobleman comes to visit. And he sees that this girl, she looks a little undernourished. So he goes over to the friend, the trusted caretaker, and says, you know, she looks a little undernourished. I mean, it was a great strategy the nobleman had, but, you know, it doesn't seem to be working. And the caretaker says adamantly, these are the orders. This is what I was told. Not a penny until she gets married. Okay. The cousin stays around in town another few days, a few weeks. And he hears that the girl is sick. Deathly ill. And there's no money for a doctor. So he goes to this caretaker again, the trusted friend, and he says, you know, maybe you could release a little money so we could hire a doctor to see her and take care of her. And this caretaker again, you know, with all due respect, but the nobleman told me she's not to see a penny until her marriage. And the cousin says to him, fool, if you don't release the money for the doctor, she ain't going to see the marriage. Sometimes HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kavayachal, our coach, he withholds blessing from us because he's saving it for the time when it's much better to get the blessing. Why would you want $100 in this world if Hashem withholds the blessing and gives you billions and trillions in the next world, where the commodities are worth much more? But at a certain point, we turn to Hashem and say, yes, but if you don't help us, we're not going to make it there. In other words, our functionality in doing mitzvahs is being impaired. And if I can't do what I'm supposed to do to get to the next world in flying colors, then that's a different demand. That's not just, it hurts a little, give me a little blessing. This is, my whole existence is being impaired. So what are you saving it for? For the wedding? For the world to come? But I'm having trouble getting there successfully. A person who's having trouble with mitzvah observance. A person who's having trouble with family life. A person who's having trouble with the basic functions of what we as Jews are supposed to be doing. That prayer is very powerful. That's pan ishan hamavas. You're facing death, so to speak, failure in the face. And that's a request that we turn to Hashem, you know, you can't turn me down. That's not just I'll weather the storm a little bit more. This is something that has to be addressed. The final verse, Pasuk Vav, verse 6, we get a sense of David's absolute confidence that his prayer will be answered. He says, Va'ani, but as for me, all things considered, Bechastecha batachti, I trust in your kindness. Yogel libi bishuasecha, I know that my heart will in the future exult in your salvation. I know it's coming. If it's today, if it's tomorrow, I know it's coming. You know, the Jewish expression always was, Mashiach is coming. Mashiach will make it right. So there were great Jews who had a suitcase packed. You know, special pair of pants. I heard one rabbi had a special cane he intended to use when he has to greet Mashiach. It's clarity that the salvation will come. Very interesting. We hear all the time about Anatoly Sharansky. I mean, at the time when he was in his heyday as a refusnik, making the headlines constantly, so his wife, Avital, was traveling the world on his behalf, trying to galvanize support. She once went into a Hasidic Rebbe asking him to support her cause, and he said, do you believe that your husband is coming out soon? She said, what do you mean? Do I believe that my husband? I mean, yeah. He says, no, but really, do you believe? She said, yeah. But now with a little bit less confidence. And then he hit her with the question. He said, do you go to mikveh? Do you really believe that your husband is coming out? Are you waiting for him? And she thought for a moment, and she smiled, and she said, I didn't yet, but I will. And from then on, she did. Because if you really believe that the salvation is coming, they have stories in Yerushalayim when there was a drought. So before they went out for communal prayer at the Western Wall, the rabbis sent out an announcement, everybody should take the laundry off the clotheslines. It's the middle of a drought. The laundry off the clotheslines. Because if we're going out to pray, we got to believe that it's going to happen. We got to believe that by the time we're coming back from the Kotel, it's going to be pouring. You got to take the clothes in. They're going to get wet. And David concludes, Ashira l'Hashem ki gomal aloi, I will sing to Hashem, because He has dealt kindly with me. Now the word gomal is a fascinating word. Rav Shamshur Felhirsch writes that the word gomal, to bestow kindness, is the same word as a gomal, as a camel. Because the camel is that animal that's living in the desert, adverse conditions, and his only care is not about himself, because he's fully provided for. His only care is to provide for others. If there's a person or there's a package on his back, that's his concern. The sandstorm doesn't bother him because he's got double eyelids and special lips. The lack of water doesn't bother him because he's got fat reserves. The sand doesn't bother him, he's got special feet that spread the weight and he's able to walk. The camel is able to bestow because he feels provided for. Likewise, a gomel chasadim, one who bestows kindness, generally you're able to bestow kindness with generosity if you feel provided for. It doesn't mean you are provided for, because we know some people can give the shirt off their back. It doesn't mean you're provided for. It means you feel provided for. Who's the ultimate one who can give without restraint? Hashem. He's the ultimate gomal, so to speak. Because the more he gives, he doesn't lose anything, because he has as much as he wants to give. And likewise, one of the most amazing levels of prayer is to realize that no matter how much Hashem gives, that doesn't in any way stop how much He can continue to give. Right? We live in a human world. So to us, if we watch someone else get a promotion, we can celebrate for them with good character traits, but deep down many people will feel a little squeamish that if he's getting the promotion, well, where does that leave me? Only one person can win the lottery, right? So, if he won it, I didn't win it. When Hashem bestows kindness, it's not like that. Actually, it's the opposite. Because if Hashem is already, so to speak, in the mood, or whatever, if we've already turned on the generosity, the blessing, so tov letzadik, tov l'shcheino, Hashem's giving him, He'll give you too. And the more blessing there is, the more opportune the time is for all of us to benefit. I'd like, therefore, to share with you a fascinating program which I recently came across. It's called Daven for Me. The program is based on a statement from our sages that says that if a person needs something, but his friend also needs that thing, if you pray for him, then you'll be answered first. And this program is pairing up people who each need something. You pair up the same thing, you pray for them, they pray for you. And to a great extent, it's based on this principle of gomal. Hashem has unlimited bounty and is willing to give it. The more we get, the more we get, because it's not limited. Purim is a very powerful time. As we mentioned, Hashem sets us up because He wants to hear our prayer. He's ready to solve the problem many times. But even if He's not ready, the prayer on Purim is the wisdom worth the proverbial $999 to know where to knock. And if you know where to give the bang, Purim is a very powerful time. It's a time of anapohu, when Hashem flips things. The expression is upside down, but really it's right side up. He flips things, he makes things right. We should be zocha that in the coming days through Purim, we should be able to recite the words beautifully, proper intent. Rabbi Kaplan recommends, by the way, 5 seconds per word. Be patient with yourself. Recite it slowly, patiently, strategically. Think about how the words impact your request. And I do have these sign-up sheets. I copied a few. Anybody who wants to join, different items that are common needs for people, they'll pair you up with someone with a similar need. You'll get their Hebrew name. They'll get your Hebrew name. And there are a lot of success stories from it. Hashem should answer all of our tefillos, the tova for good. I thank you very much for joining. A wonderful, happy Purim to all.